O'Brien, and this is Boston University's World of Ideas. Recently, two very symbolic events occurred, one honoring the past, the other the future. The first at Marsh Chapel found President John Westling presenting the stones from the original base of the Martin Luther King Jr. Monument in Marsh Plaza as a gift to Dr. King's other alma mater, Morehouse College. The gift was accepted by the Reverend Dr. Otis Moss, Jr., chair of the Morehouse College Board of Trustees. The Reverend Moss subsequently delivered the Samuel DeWitt Proctor Memorial Sermon. The second event took place on the basketball courts of BU's Shed, as it's known, where the West End House honored veterans of past wars with the first of 10 Sundays of a Young People's Basketball League. The West End House is a direct descendant of the Settlement House that provided a home away from home for thousands of youngsters of a bygone era, and still does so today. And we'll be paying them a visit. But first, from Marsh Chapel, the King presentation. Here is Boston University Chancellor John Silver.
Morehouse College and Boston University have a shared interest in Martin Luther King, Jr., for he is an alumnus of both institutions. But in the course of his life, he transcended both institutions to become one of the greatest moral and spiritual leaders of the 20th century. We erected at Boston University the first memorial in the United States to Martin Luther King, Jr. We did so in 1975, the sculpture Free at Last by the Chilean sculptor Sergio Castillo. I was asked by a black student, "Why a Chilean?" Castillo answered, "Martin Luther King, Jr. belongs not only to this country, but to the world." On the base of the sculpture are inscribed three quotations that attempt to sum the essence of King's message. We inscribe them there for our students to read as a part of their education, the way in which the Catholic Church offers the Stations of the Cross to teach laymen the central tenets of the Christian faith. These quotations are from the letter from a Birmingham jail and his address on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial in 1963. These works belong to the literary classics of all time, not only to the American classics, but to the classics of the world. King's sources, as he himself acknowledged, were Jesus, Socrates, Amos, St. Augustine, St. Thomas Aquinas, Martin Luther, Martin Buber, Paul Tillich, Thomas Jefferson, and Immanuel Kant. In order to distinguish himself and his followers who broke the laws in a campaign of nonviolence from those who violate the laws under other circumstances, King wrote, and I quote, "I hope you can see the distinction I'm trying to point out. In no sense do I advocate evading or defying the law as the rabid segregationists would do. This would lead to anarchy. One who breaks an unjust law must do it openly, lovingly, not hatefully, as the white mothers did in New Orleans when they were seen on television screaming, 'Nigger, nigger, nigger,' and with a willingness to accept the penalty." And he concluded, and this is one of the inscriptions on the stones, "I submit that an individual who breaks a law that conscience tells him is unjust and willingly accepts the penalty by staying in jail to arouse the conscience of the community over its injustice is in reality expressing the very highest respect for law." His nonviolent campaign is not to be confused with terrorism, not only because of the lack of violence, but because he directed his movement against those who were the very deniers of his rights. When they had campaigns in lunch counters, it was the owners of the lunch counters who denied the Negroes access. When he insisted on the right to sit in any seat on the bus, it was the owners of the bus companies who had decided to segregate the seating arrangement. This is not to pick random targets, but to pick specific targets, those who offend, those who are themselves unjust in specific ways. King was not an ideologue, but one who searched for truth and justice. He didn't believe in the now politically correct deconstructionist view that there is no truth, but only male truth or female truth, white truth or black truth. Rather, he sought truth itself. On the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, he said, and I quote, "We must not allow our creative protests to generate into physical violence. Again and again, we must rise to the majestic heights of meeting physical force with soul force. The marvelous new militancy which has engulfed the Negro community must not lead us to distrust all white people, for many of our white brothers, as evidenced by their presence here today, have come to realize that their destiny is tied up with our destiny." He went on to say, and this is another of our inscriptions, "We must come to see that the end we seek is a society of peace. That will be the day not of the white man, not of the black man. That will be the day of man as man." And following the teachings of Jesus, he added, and this is the third inscription, "Far from being the pious injunction of a utopian dreamer, the command to love one's enemies is an absolute necessity for our survival." These quotations inscribed on these stones are a part of the legacy of Martin Luther King, Jr. And from these inscriptions, we and many generations to come have much to learn.
Dr. Moss, it is my great pleasure on behalf of Boston University to present Morehouse College with the original engraved stone panels of our monument to Martin Luther King, Jr. In Exodus, we read that the Lord gave unto Moses, when he had made an end of communing with him upon Mount Sinai, two tables of testimony, tables of stone written with the finger of God. Our tablets of stone are written by human hands, but they too are tables of testimony that deserve to be handed down the generations. And may these tablets, weathered by a generation of New England winters, continue to be a reminder of our friendship of learning and to shine in the Atlanta sunshine with the great words of a great son of our two institutions. The scripture reading from the book of Joshua today recalls the Lord's command that the people of Israel commemorate their safe passage across the Jordan River with 12 stones cut out of the place where the priest's feet stood firm. The stones, we are reminded, were supposed to stand as a memorial unto the children of Israel forever. On an occasion on which we commemorate the friendship of Boston University and Morehouse College with a gift of stones, we ought to consider this as something of a cautionary tale. The stones cut from the banks of the River Jordan, like the Ark of the Covenant itself, have been lost in the tides of time. It is not they, but the commandment to remember God's covenant that survives. We give tablets of stone that they may remind generations of the abiding ties between Morehouse College and the university that was fortunate enough to know Howard Thurman, Martin Luther King, Jr., and many more of Morehouse's great sons. But our covenant cannot rest merely on stones. Covenants written only on stone are dead. For them to live, they must be written on the heart. Today, the Samuel DeWitt Proctor Memorial Sermon offers us a chance to renew enduring friendships in that spirit. We remember the Reverend Dr. Proctor for sermons and speeches, including some here from this pulpit, in which he gave substance in his commanding voice to a civil rights movement that dared to cross the barriers of segregation. We also remember the faith that guided Samuel Proctor during his years of service in government, in the presidency of two universities, and in the pulpit of Harlem's Abyssinian Baptist Church. The faith to which Dr. Proctor gave evidence in word and deed has also inspired the remarkable achievements of our guest today. The son of a sharecropper from LaGrange, Georgia, the Reverend Dr. Otis Moss, Jr. studied at Morehouse College, the Morehouse School of Religion, Interdenominational Theological Center, and the United Theological Seminary. His extraordinary gifts have led him from the old Mount Olive Baptist Church in his hometown to ministries in Atlanta, Lockland, Ohio, and finally to Cleveland's Olivet Institutional Baptist Church, where he has been pastor for more than 25 years. Now the distinguished chairman of the Board of Trustees of Morehouse College, Otis Moss is one of the nation's greatest preachers. It is my great privilege to welcome to the university a man in whose heart is written the covenant that once inspired the children of Israel to cross the Jordan and that still inspires those who journey towards a promised land of amity and brotherhood. Dr. Moss.
Thank you for these kind words of introduction. In behalf of the Board of Trustees of Morehouse College, members of the faculty of Morehouse, staff and student body, and that ever-widening circle of alumni, we accept these stones of memory, these stones that are testaments and testimonies of our continuing struggle and our abiding hope. We accept these stones in memory of our friend, brother and leader, Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr., and those upon whose shoulders he stood in the formation of his own ministry, and in behalf of those who will come after us, who may never know our names or read our obituaries, but they will see something good, something true, and something beautiful. And the weary traveler will perhaps pause on his and her journey and shout, "Hallelujah! God is good." And somebody unknown to the proclaimer will respond all the time. Let me say that Dr. Anthony Campbell belongs to Morehouse, Howard, and Boston University. He had an early arrival at Morehouse and somewhat an early departure. But Howard University, led by a Morehouse man who also had an unscheduled departure from Morehouse, and sat out a semester for having committed the strange misdeed of playing cards on Sunday. But somehow Mordecai Johnson, Dr. Campbell, did not go back home, nor did he inform his parents that he had been momentarily suspended. He went to Chicago and lived with a relative and sent all of his mail back to Morehouse to his roommate, and his roommate forwarded the mail to his parents. And they never knew he was gone. He graduated valedictorian and went on to become the first African-American president of Howard University against the advice of some of the most trusted elders and philanthropists of his day. And we have here today a special kind of reunion. I want to call to your attention a scripture in the Epistle of John, First Epistle of John, chapter 3, verse 2. And I want to lift up a portion of that verse from the New Revised Standard Version. Now, the King James Version says, "Beloved, now we are the sons of God, and it doth not yet appear what we shall be." The New Revised Standard Version says, "Beloved, we are God's children now, and what we shall be has not yet been revealed." And I want to say a word about unrevealed victories. If we were going to do a series, I would probably start with what it means to be children of God, and then continue and borrow from Paul Tillich's eternal now and talk about now. Just now. Now. And also emphasize what it means to live with a healthy, creative, dynamic perspective on the future. And then that verse also says, "But we know we shall be like him." And my, how we could speak about what it means and in our sanctified imagination, to borrow from my colleague Wyatt T. Walker, what it means in our sanctified imagination to be like God. Unrevealed victories. I think that God hides many of the victories already given to us in order that they might be revealed at the appropriate time. For if we could see them in their early realities, we would probably participate in a declaration of war upon them. God often hides our blessings until we can grow up to them. God often hides our victories until we are mature enough to proclaim them. God often hides our victories, I could even say, until we are holy enough to hold them. God often hides our victories until we are wise enough to interpret, apply, understand, and execute life under their scrutiny and their power, and thereby finding within ourselves a special kind of fulfillment, not only for ourselves, but for generations yet unborn. And I'm glad that God does hide our victories. Sometimes God wraps up our victories in the tender flesh of little children, and they are born, and we cannot look at them and know what they will become. Every time I dedicate a child over the past 40 years, I always hold that child in my hand and say, "Dear God, we do not know what is wrapped up in this precious bit of human flesh, but thou knowest and thou carest." Then I borrow something from that Lebanese poet and artist who said, "Your children are not your children. They come through you, but not from you. They are the sons and daughters of life's longing for itself." And to paraphrase, you can give them your love, but not your dreams. They must dream their own dreams and follow their own star and catch their own vision. And you know, catching a vision is remarkable. I have a colleague in the ministry who talks about her little boy when he was quite young, involved in nursery school and learning something about germs and bacteria. They were out playing one day, and in the backyard, it was a hot day, and she was drinking lemonade from one of those massive glass cups, or maybe goblets. And he rushed by and said, "Mama, can I drink some of your lemonade?" And she said, "Yes." And he picked it up and then paused and said, "Mama, if I drink from this cup, will I catch your dreams?"
We welcome now Reverend Anthony Cardoza Campbell, the preacher in residence at Marsh Chapel and professor of homiletics at Boston University. Good to have you with us again.
Good to be here, Ted. Thank you.
We've just heard a few excerpts from Thursday's ceremony, and I'd like to ask, why is Boston University sending these stones from the King Memorial to Morehouse College? What prompted it, and who came up with the idea?
In the foundations of Boston University are several pieces of the fabric, and that's what they call it in England, the fabric of major universities. It is an old tradition that when a new university is founded, or when you have some historic moral, theological, intellectual connection, that you give part of yourself to that school. When they were dismantling and rehabilitating Marsh Plaza and the King Monument, I had suggested to the men who were doing it and the officials here at the university that we preserve even the stones that were coming off, even the chipped stones, because I knew this was a historic moment. And then later on, I wrote President Wessling saying, why not give, and using the English language, part of the fabric of this school to Martin's other school. Now, you will note on the monument, even the one that's there now, it says, "Distinguished Alumnus, Nobel Laureate." But it doesn't say what school. And without changing one word, our schools are connected by those words.
Tell us about the young Martin Luther King, Jr. You and he had parallel lives in many ways, and you knew each other for many years.
Martin's father, Daddy King as he was called, and his mother were friends of my mother and father. And you have to understand, in those days, there was a connectedness that's almost tribal. That is to say, you have Martin Luther King, class of 48, having a literate introduction from his father to Howard Thurman, class of 23. And my father wrote Howard Thurman saying, "Remember when we were at a particular meeting." That's one part. The second part is that by the time I was ready to consider colleges, Martin had been to BU, and it was in my head that what he got, he must have gotten here. and I wanted to study with the same people who had made him what he became. I was a Morehouse man, as he was. I studied with the same people who had taught him. There are names that Morehouse men would recognize: Polly Vu, who was a French teacher, and GLC, who was a graduate of Middlebury, who encouraged us to use language well. And that fluid grandiloquence that Martin had is a part of that tradition. So to come here is a part of that connectiveness. Our parents were friends. We came to the same people here to get to know them, Howard Thurman and Roland Hayes. And my father was one of the early contributors to the Montgomery bus boycott.
What was it like then? Did your paths cross? Did you have a lot in common besides what you've just described?
I met Martin probably on 5 different occasions, but they were very long occasions. I was not part of that inner circle, who were mostly older men who were pastors. One of the things about the celebration and what you just recently heard is that everybody on that program was connected with Martin for 40 years or more. We were all friends. The second part of it is that Martin was the one who legitimized for me the kind of African-American preaching which has gone around the world. He was the first African-American preacher to be heard as an international ecclesiological executive or prophet. And it made me feel that preaching, rather than being some low form of speech or loudly given lecture, could have resonance and power and go far, far beyond the speaker.
What did you hear during Thursday's ceremony that for you evoked the spirit of Dr. King?
The event has been entitled, as you can tell from the head of the program, as Dreams and Stones. And the readings in the scripture started out with, "Behold, the dreamer comes, let's kill him." The second reading is, "When your children ask what these stones mean, tell them that God delivered you." And the last reading says, "And then the landowner sent his son, and they killed him also. But that stone rejected has become the stone of the world." Remember, Martin, in the last part of his life, was on the run. He was being discredited. They were taking away speaking engagements. Nobody wanted to hear him published. Even the black community had grown tired of his activism. So here is Martin standing now as a resonant light on every continent. There's a King Monument, a King Street, or a King School in every country in the world. Who else? Who else in our whole history has merited that kind of attention?
He was also an outspoken advocate of nonviolent protest. How should we apply his philosophies today in light of the September attacks on New York and Washington? Is there guidance to be found in his work and his interpretations?
You know, it's a strange thing, and this is going to probably get me in a little bit of trouble, but I don't find any civil rights leaders now who literally are willing to risk everything for that principle. Wouldn't it be wonderful if Jesse Jackson and Tony Campbell and a group of our friends made lunch in the middle of the street of Annapolis? Wouldn't it be terrific if we went up to the dangerous zone between Protestant and Catholics, who aren't either, but these militant thugs, and said in the middle of that, "We're going to make peace here"? Wouldn't it be terrific if Jesse got called by some of Bin Laden's people? Jesse should have gone. He should have risked something. He should have died for peace, as Martin did. And I think nonviolence is still the applicable way. Even with this huge tragedy we've had, we could kill 6,100 of them and only make 60,000 bin Ladens. There has to be a better way.
How do you incorporate his words and the friendship that you had with him into the work that you do now?
I think one of the missing parts of the movement, and I've commented on this before, is that very rarely do any of the films or the outtakes show the music that preceded the words. The music literally was the catechism of the movement. You didn't have to say what the Promised Land was because everybody was singing it before you heard the Promised Land. And you did not have to say what it meant to be delivered. Everybody knew that. I think the music of the movement is still subversive and contraintuitive. For instance, this past week or so, we were preaching. Everybody was preaching on Lazarus. And yet there's a Negro spiritual that says, "Rock my soul in the bosom of Abraham." It is a poor man in Abraham's bosom saying to a rich man, "Not what you did to me, but what you didn't do. You didn't even notice me." That message is still relevant, and especially in these times.
Most of the students and the young people who will be most affected by the events of the coming months and years weren't born until more than a decade after Dr. King's death. Is he still a relevant figure for them, or has he become a kind of historical abstraction, like a Lincoln, Washington, a giant from the distant past?
It is easiest for African Americans and militant students to get access to, say, a Malcolm X. He is more easily reduced to a buzzword by any means necessary. But people forget that Malcolm wore a business suit, and he conjugated verbs. He did not wear costumes. Martin is more difficult to access because he's more complicated. And the complication is he seems rather politically incorrect. His basso profundo voice is too preachy. But if you read his words, they leap off the page and they beat you up badly. That is why people were singing We Shall Overcome at Tiananmen Square and the Berlin Wall. That is why Martin is recognized around the world as this drum major for peace that he always imagined. But young people are into a kind of USA Today approach to learning. They want a quick soundbite. They want it in 15 minutes. And it takes years to get what Martin got because he stood on a tradition that was 3 centuries old or 19 centuries old if you go back to the founding of the church.
Let's step aside once more from the historical figure. Tell us about Martin Luther King Jr., the man, the student, the man.
He was as ordinary as you can imagine. He ate chicken with his fingers. He liked to tell great jokes. He would give you titles. Come over here, doctor. Come over here, young doctor. Come over here, young Campbell. And you felt you needed to come. On the other hand, he was extraordinarily vulnerable. He was a brooding presence. He could sit in a corner and say nothing to anyone. I remember meetings with Stokely Carmichael where we would be arguing and jumping up and down. And Martin wouldn't say anything for hours and hours on end. He said, well, let's do it this way. Or he was, oh, come on, Stokely. Oh, come on, Campbell. He had this aw shucks manner which masked this incredibly disciplined mind. On the other hand, I think revisionist historians will have to admit that the Civil Rights Movement was the most chaotic event ever to move anywhere. It didn't know where it was going. It was making case law every day. We didn't know when we would win or lose. It was a children's crusade. And I look back on it and said, how did we ever think we could go up against these guys who had everything, including a passive FBI, that we could not penetrate? And yet, with the moral authority and the creating of that political moment, that wonderful wrinkle in time where the President of the United States says it's not right that an American citizen can't cross that bridge and walk to Montgomery. And Martin had that ability in that homespun way and that extremely disciplined mind to move people to where they'd never been before.
You have told me on other occasions that his preeminence in the Birmingham bus boycott was an accident of factions that needed a neutral party. Could you tell that story again?
Yeah, it's the Montgomery bus boycott.
Montgomery, I'm sorry.
He was the new kid in town, and everybody had luggage and everybody had enemies. And Abernathy, who was the logical leader, who had all the presence and the voice and whatnot, literally put Martin up because he had no enemies. Now, that is one of those accidental moments where the man and moment came together. I don't think anybody had any idea of the quality of his speech or of his mind. He was new. He had a great name. He was the Big Mike, MLK Sr.'s son. But there was no reason whatsoever that he should have been elected. And kind of like Napoleon walking in shorter than everybody else, and nobody would tip their hat to him. So he took his hat off, and when they took theirs off, he put his back on and he was in charge. Martin did not need any of the titles to be who he was. And that superbly suited him in a way that was not ego-driven. He didn't start off by saying, now I'm Dr. Martin Luther King and pay attention. He would usually tell people, I'm Mike King. That was the intimate inside name. I'm Mike, because he was originally Michael King, and he changed his name later to Martin Luther King. But he was the accidental leader who became the quintessential prophet.
How would you explain to someone who did not know him and is not familiar with his work how he would fare today?
It is almost difficult to do it in terms that are not very heroic, but let me give someone else who is accessible in our lifetimes. Mandela walked out of prison with a smile. He invited his jailers to his inauguration. He was that old man deeply flavored by the Englishness of his training and education. Martin was a respecter of Western civilization. He was not a hater of it. He had been trained in the classics, as we all were at the African-American schools. He was taught that you conjugated a verb and you had to have mastery of your language to be persuasive. So I would say to young people, if you want instant Martin, it doesn't exist. If you would take the discipline of reading, maybe even with a dictionary in hand, come off the internet, get out of ESPN, take off the Nikes, and read and see if you would have had the nerve. Not to jam things up, any fool can do that, but to rebuild a whole culture around concepts that are deeply embedded in the documents of this nation. They were written by a bunch of racist men. Everybody owned slaves except Adams, and yet they gave truths that far exceeded them, which Martin reinterpreted, reclaimed, and presented at a retail level to common, ordinary people. I don't see any of the movements now being other than middle-class privilege masquerading as oppression.
And the idea that he's timeless, that in any time he would rise, that's my perception. Is that yours?
Not exactly. I think that it would be very difficult now in this kind of jaded, scandal-mongering press for Martin to have gone below the radar scope in terms of his own faults. We've created a whole industry finding people's faults. And secondly, I think that the times would have killed Martin sooner. Now, it sounds like a terrible thing to say, but he literally died at the right possible moment to be heroic. If he had lived, he would be an aging social ethicist waiting for retirement, like all the other social ethicists I know are waiting for retirement. Or he would have gone about the dangerous work of preaching when people would have said, he's messianic, he's politically incorrect, he doesn't have any women on the dais with him. They would have tried to marginalize him. But I think where Martin would have come to the fore is he would have been able to teach a new generation that there are powers in words and experience that properly shared are transforming. And that's what he did. People said, well, you know, he plagiarized his PhD document. Well, there's a lot of plagiarism in universities. But nobody's ever stepped up to claim, I have a dream. That's his. He wrote that. Nobody stepped up to claim, we will have difficult times, but we're ready for difficult times. We're going to march out of this church and love redemptively. And I said to myself, hell no, we will not march out of this church and love redemptively. But the words resound. They still resound.
Well, I want to thank you, Reverend Campbell, for joining us to speak about that day this past week when the stones from the Martin Luther King Monument passed from Boston University to Morehouse College in a symbolic and real gesture of solidarity with his past.
The parting of that fabric to that other school is a great moment, and thank you for letting me be a part of it.
Another recent event at Boston University, in addition to the outreach to Morehouse College, was a very community-oriented celebration of another kind. And here to talk about it is Director of Community Affairs, Joe Walsh. Good to have you with us, Joe.
Thank you very much.
Tell us a little bit about how the basketball tournament honoring veterans came about, its purposes, and what it means to the community.
Well, it came about certainly in reaction to the tragedy of September 11th. However, I think it was long overdue. Thinking recently about how a lot of the young people, even my children, my oldest boy is 23 years old, have not been in this country at a time when we were at war. And even myself, I was certainly alive during Vietnam, but I was very young. So that a lot of young people don't realize that there have been tremendous sacrifices made by people in the past. And certainly now with this crisis on the horizon, there could be sacrifices by people in the future. And I think that Maureen Kapinski was one of our BU students who volunteered at the West End House for the past 4 years and was a member of ROTC, and she now is stationed. She's in the Navy and is out in San Diego awaiting her order. So this was somewhat in dedication to not only the veterans of the past, but also those who will serve the country in the future.
And what role did the West End House play in it? I understand that this is a community asset that goes way back to the days of the West End. It was transferred out to Alston Brighton and is now flourishing there.
Yes. The West End House has been in Alston Brighton since 1971. I was fortunate enough to grow up in the building next to the West End House. And later we're going to hear from Stephanie Wong, who lives across the street from the West End House. But we've had basketball since I've been a member were there in 1971. And the league, which is sponsored by State Representative Kevin Honan for the past 15 years, happens every fall, and it involves boys and girls from the ages of 8 to 15 years old. And that was going to happen and does happen every single year. And it just seemed like it was a natural fit. These were kids that needed to understand what was going on, and not certainly from a point of being terrorized or anything like that, but rather understanding that there are people who are sacrificing to protect them.
You mentioned Kevin Honan. He's been involved with the West End House since he was a kid. And at the tournament, he explained why he came and what renovation of the West End House will do.
I have been going to the West End House since I was a young kid. I grew up in Alston, Brighton, so I've been attending the West End House since it was created in 1971 when I was about 11 years old. So I have a personal history with the West End House. The West End House presently is under construction. They're fixing it up, and we didn't have a place to play. So Boston University was kind enough to offer us their facilities for this league, which is in its 16th year and services boys and girls 13 and under. So it's a wonderful opportunity for neighborhood kids to play, and we couldn't do it without Boston University's help. The renovation will take approximately another year, and it'll add several thousand square feet to the building. They're going to be able to put in a computer training program, a dance facility, and a youth center. So it's a strong addition to the building, what they're proposing, what they're in fact doing right now. So the neighborhood's very excited about this.
That was Kevin Honan, state representative for the 17th Suffolk District. Of course, the real centerpiece of this whole effort is the kids. And, for example, we're going to talk with Stephanie Wong in a moment, but we did hear from Najee Stafford. He's one of the youngsters who uses the services provided by the West End House, and he was asked what West End House does for him.
It helps us with our homework, and it makes us do fun things, and we get to play basketball. And so, but when we're redoing, we're at a church, and they help us with our homework. We have art activities, books. We have a playroom, and we play Foursquare and stuff. I feel good because I've never been in a college before.
Here's a youngster whose first experience with a college was Boston University, Joe.
He's only 8 years old, but it seems as though he's been a member for about 15 years. He's there day in, day out in the West End House. I know certainly, like it did for me, and a whole bunch of kids will have a positive impact on Najee's life.
And Stephanie, what do you do there? The homework, as Najee was talking about? What else?
The club, it's good for us to hang out with friends and just relax. I get my homework done there sometimes. And then afterward, I just like play in the games room with the younger kids, just hang around with them. And also whenever it comes to sports, everyone loves doing that. And
you were telling me that you were interested in going on to college once you're finished. You're a ninth grader now. Mm-hmm. You're in high school. Has the West End House helped you raise your sights a little bit about what's possible in the world?
Yeah, it sure has, because they have they explain to us about how we can get somewhere and how we're just not nothing. Like, we can make a change in our lives. Going to college is one big thing.
Joe?
As I said, the West End House certainly was a family for me, a family away from home, and we haven't put any basketball players in Division I yet, but we're proud to say we put some students into Division I colleges. And so the mission, I think, is well served. And the majority of kids, Ted, come from low income. While I believe that we're probably in the greatest neighborhood in anywhere in the world, when you're surrounded by the likes of people that you'd meet at Boston University, Boston College, and Harvard University within a mile of the West End House, people seem to forget that within that inner circle, there are four housing projects, and that makes up the 1,200 members that we serve. That's where they come from.
And this gives them an idea of what the possibilities of this country are.
Absolutely.
Here's a parent, Mary Randolph, who had some comments on what the program meant to her family.
Well, what it does, it helps get them off the street. It also helps motivate them, the self-esteem. To know that there's other people other than their parents that cares about them, that, you know, want them to be somebody in life, you know. And the West End House helps not only the family within their house, but it helps a family West End House is like a family. It's like everybody's together. If you have a problem, you know, you always have somebody at the West End House. Volunteering is very important because it shows the kids that if they see college students volunteering, it shows that they're volunteering their time. You're not helping yourself, but you're also helping the other child and the other kids.
Joe, was this an extended family for you when you were a kid?
Absolutely, yeah. Unfortunately, my dad was a victim of a mugging at 9 years old and has been institutionalized ever since, and my mother had her own issues. So the West End House, I shudder to think, Ted, if the West End House was not beside our building, I guess things happened for a reason, and that must be why, although I grew up in FHA housing, they built this club right next door to us. And, you know, I met Kevin Honan and Brian Honan there and a lot of other guys who have been lifelong friends, and they provided the discipline that we need and the family.
You're giving back now, you and a lot of other volunteers. One of them was Jim Panettiere, Matt Bayonne, and both of them are talking about what it feels like to volunteer. It's not all give. It's a lot of get.
This is a volunteer effort. I started way back in 93. I started coaching at the West End House, which is a Boys and Girls Club in Austin. And just coming back every fall, it's been a lot of fun. And seeing a lot of the kids grow and mature over the years has been great.
I live in the Austin Brighton community and have volunteered with the Honan League for the past couple of years and also in general with the West End House. And I feel it's a really important thing to give back to the community, also see the kids grow. I work for the Big Brother Association, so I see it on other levels too, and what kind of impact volunteers can have.
Actually, as Joe mentioned earlier, one thing he would like to say and would prefer is every game to end in a tie, because competition, that nature, isn't really what he's trying to do here, but try to get people to work together. And I accept all sorts of different people. It's a lot of diversity in the area, and I've seen a lot of the young people develop friendships, and that's what really this is for.
Well, let's test that Joe Walsh premise for a moment, Stephanie. Do you want to see every game end in a tie?
Well, that would be much better because it does get competitive on the court. And sometimes it hurts other kids if they don't win. And they get sad and kind of angry about it. And it bothers the people who win because they want to show that everyone tried their best and that it should have ended in tie so that everyone was equal, no matter what, because the game time doesn't really matter as long as they played and had fun.
Boy, that's impressive. I thought I was going to kid Joe a little bit, but you really put me in my place. Are you going to volunteer there someday?
Yeah, sure.
All right, let's listen to what those games were like. Here's the sounds of the West End tournament.
All right, we got to watch Stephanie Long, you guys. She's scoring all their points. Double it up. You stay in the paint and watch Ramanaj, okay? You two guys stay on Tara, okay? One of you stay on Tara and the other of you stay on Eliza, okay?
I want to go in.
It's all about defense. You guys keep your head up on the way down. Nice fast break. Wait, keep your head up. You see that nice pass to you? That was beautiful. That was, like, textbook. Yeah, and I'm going to get you in for...
Can I get in?
Was your sister just in?
No.
Stephanie, do you need a break? I'll get you in for Stephanie and Morgan. All right? All right, guys.
Don't worry about the score, yo. Don't worry about the score. We got time. Just play hard, yo.
We got time. We got, like, 6 minutes left.
Take your time on offense, yo. Take your time. You check the kids. I'm going to get the
play.
Yo, you just pass up. Everybody, we got to find him in, yo.
Yo, get him. Number 13 right there. I'll show you who to get. I don't know who else is out there.
All right, come on, yo. Don't worry about the score, yo.
But now I'm a little confused. On the one hand, Stephanie, you say that every game should end in a tie, but on the other, you're clearly a very competitive player when you're out there scoring those points.
Yeah, I get into the game a lot. It's fun, and I try my best every game, and
Of course you do. And you try to balance out the competition so that nobody goes home feeling bad, Joe.
Well, we try as best we can. And Stephanie in the in-house league is a great role model. She helps the younger girls. But when she gets on our traveling team and we go out and play other places, they take no prisoners. Stephanie is there to win when we go out and play in Nashua, New Hampshire, or Salem, Massachusetts, or down to Rhode Island. And they've had great success outside of the West End House.
Now, the tournament took place at Boston University, but the volunteers come from all over. And here's a college student by the name of Jason Brown from Emmanuel College who answered the question, why help out? Why is this important?
Why is it important? It's always important to come back and help out little kids. I used to remember when I was their age, I used to love having people from college come up and help me work on my skills or watch me play. So I know exactly how these little kids feel.
Boy, I'll tell you, that's the key, isn't it? To raise people's sights by showing them the possibilities in the world and showing what other people have done with their lives. Joe Walsh.
Absolutely. The West End House will continue. It's, as we say at the West End House, the spirit never dies. And although they were moved out of the West End House more than 30 years ago, they'll continue for another 30 years and hopefully another 50 and 100 years serving. Hopefully, well, if things worked out, Ted, someday we wouldn't be in need for a place like the West End House.
Well, but as long as there is, people like you and Stephanie Wong will be there to take the next generation of kids through what you went through. This is an ongoing thing. This isn't a one-time-only Sunday afternoon thing.
That's correct. The program runs for 10 weeks right up until December 16th, and that is when most of the volunteers would go home for their holiday breaks. And it will be six games every Sunday, 10:30, 11:30, 12:30 at the BU Shed. And again, we'd like to thank Boston University for providing that facility.
If someone wants to get involved, how do they do it?
Well, to be frank and not too brutally honest, we've got plenty of volunteers right now. Between the BU students, it was a tremendous, and at Emmanuel College, all of the men's varsity players are doing it. How someone could get involved, we are doing a $6 million renovation of the West End House, and we've got about $4 million in the bank. So that's how someone could get involved.
That's right. Can't use you for the time this time. But send the cash.
That's right.
Okay. Thank you, Joe Walsh, Stephanie Wong. I'm Ted O'Brien. This is Boston University's World of Ideas. Thanks tonight to our special guests, Boston University Preacher-in-Residence and Professor of Homiletics, the Reverend Anthony Cardoza Campbell, Joe Walsh, Boston University Director of Community Affairs, and from the West End House, Stephanie Wong. Join us again next week when we'll examine the question of bilingual education. For a cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287 and join the conversation at buwi.org. Our webmaster is Angel Cazelli. Tonight's program was produced by Jake Zuckerman, Vince Fairchild, and Chris Bannon. I'm Ted O'Brien. Thanks for being with us.
This is WBUR Boston.